Connor gets 1 minute, I'll switch it to you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Open Secrets. This is episode 14, where we're talking about Zbigniew Brzezinski's 1970 book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. I apologize, it has been quite some time since I was able to record an episode of this show for you. So I would like to reintroduce myself. My name is Dr. Dan Stanislawski. I hold a PhD in molecular biology and biochemistry. However, I don't let that degree limit myself, because certainly the truths of this world are not limited to such a specialized knowledge set as that. And certainly the explanatory truths of what's happening in our reality are certainly not limited to that as well. Now, last time I talked about The Creature from Jekyll Island, and it was a very long, I think it was 4-episode show. Hopefully this one we can keep it to 1 episode, and this is actually a very important work, as well as all of these shows are. But at the end of The Creature from Jekyll Island, I said the next book I would be doing is a book called Dope Inc. or Dope Incorporated, and that book actually turned out to be quite disappointing. As I was going through it, they were making all kinds of bold claims and having no references whatsoever to their claims, and so I kind of gave up on that. And then what happened was I got myself into some other projects that didn't really pan out, and I was spinning my wheels, so to speak, for a number of months, which is unfortunate. But now here we are. So without further ado, let's get into Zbigniew Brzezinski's Between Two Ages. Now, Zbigniew Brzezinski had a PhD from Harvard, and he was faculty there. He was into political science. And then he was at Columbia University, where he was the head of the Institute on Communist Affairs, and then he eventually went to work for Johns Hopkins. But he was also a counselor to Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, and became the National Security Advisor for Jimmy Carter. He also started an organization called the Trilateral Commission, which is a kind of globalist think tank, where it was kind of working on bringing Western Europe, Japan, and the United States into a closer union and working more closely together. This book is perhaps considered his best, his magnum opus, if you will. But he does have a lot of other books, mainly on communism, because he was an avid student of communism. And truly, I think he was a Marxist. I don't think he admitted that. Certainly, he was in the Democratic Party, obviously, and he was very liberal in his ideology. But in this book, I think he kind of lays it out, which we won't really get into, but he lays out that he enjoys Marxism, and he thought that communism was a poor instantiation of the Marxist philosophy. In fact, it became a rigid, institutionalized, bureaucratic form of Marxism. But nonetheless, this book is about it's called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. And so he's talking about what's going to happen into America in this era of transition, which we're nearing an end. But I think he's absolutely right in pointing out that we are in transition. We are heading to a new type of human life, and America's role is very important in this, but it will diminish, as we will see. So without further ado, let's get into some of his own words. And as all of these books, if there's a really good point in the introduction, I like to read them. Obviously, if there's a really good point in any part of these books, I read them. But the intros, I always appreciate a good introduction. And so we'll start there. Perhaps the time has passed for the comprehensive grand vision. In some ways, it was a necessary substitute for ignorance, a compensation in breadth for the lack of depth in man's understanding of his world. And I say here, how ignorant is man of his world now? Unless you understand some of the stuff we talk about here in Open Secrets, and that's really what Open Secrets is too, is putting a grand vision on what's happening in our reality. What's the truth of our reality, what's actually happening to us. And he's kind of making a grand declaration of what is happening in the 1960s and what is to come. But even if this is so, the result of more knowledge may be greater ignorance, or at least the feeling of ignorance about where we are and where we are heading, and particularly where we should head, than was true when in fact we knew less but thought we knew more. I am not sure that this need be so. In any case, I am not satisfied with the fragmented, microscopic understanding of the parts, and I feel the need for some, even if crude, approximation of a larger perspective. This book is an effort to provide such a perspective. It is an attempt to define the meaning within a dynamic framework of a major aspect of our contemporary reality, the emerging global political process, which increasingly blurs the traditional distinctions between domestic and international politics. In working toward that definition, I shall focus particularly on the meaning for the United States of the emergence of this process, seeking to draw implications from an examination of the forces that are molding it. I'm going to pause here for just a second. Zbigniew Brzezinski was a technocrat as well. So he, in starting things like the Trilateral Commission, which was seed granted by Rockefeller money, he was very much on the level of the Huxley boys, or the Charles Galton Darwins, like you mentioned, or the Bertrand Russells. He was one who was bringing into reality that which his masters wanted. And so these men, if you've watched several episodes of Open Secrets, you know that these guys write kind of like people with forked tongues. You know, they say one thing, it sounds nice and sounds good, but the meaning that they're actually meaning with those words is totally different than what your average Joe will get out of that. So that's an important thing to understand. And I will, of course, bring that up again, but Zbigniew Brzezinski was a big-time technocrat, and he passed away in 2017, relatively recently, actually. Time and space shape our perception of reality. The specific moment and the particular setting dictate the way international estimates and priorities are defined. Sometimes when the moment is historically ripe, the setting and the time may coalesce to provide a special insight. A perceptive formula is easier to articulate in a moment of special stress. Conditions of war, crisis, tension are in that sense particularly fertile. The situation of crisis permits sharper value judgments in keeping with man's ancient proclivity for dividing his reality into good and evil. But short of that critical condition, global politics do not lend themselves to pat formulations and clear-cut predictions, even in a setting of extensive change. A result, in most times, is extraordinarily difficult to liberate. It is extraordinarily difficult to liberate oneself from the confining influence of the immediate and to perceive, from a detached perspective, the broader sweep of events. Now, we are certainly in crisis after crisis. We live through crisis after crisis after crisis, all of them manufactured. But the thing is, human psyche is such that we can only handle so many crises. And when there are crises in personal life, plus a perceived crisis like COVID-19, like 9/11, like a, you know, World War III with the United States and Russia and China, you know, people can't handle that. People's psyches tend to break down, and they become more susceptible to suggestion, and any resultant solution that is proffered to them, they become more likely to accept. So it's what he's saying here is it's difficult to extract oneself from that the tension of the crisis moment to see what's actually happening, to step back. And that is absolutely the case. It is vital that we step back and understand what's happening, and that these dictocrats are trying to, not just trying, they are being very successful in ushering us into further enslavement. Any abstract attempt to arrive at a capsule formula is bound to contain a measure of distortion. The influences that condition relations among states in the broad evolution of international affairs are too various. Nonetheless, as long as we are aware that any such formulation inescapably contains a germ of falsehood and hence must be tentative, the attempt represents an advance toward at least a partial understanding. I'm going to pause here too, and this is what we're trying to do with Open Secrets. Not every single thing I say is going to be exactly correct. We are left to speculate, unfortunately, about a great many things. It should not be this way in a true open free society. Right? Am I wrong? I think I'm right about that at least, right? So in making these deductions from limited data, certainly some things that I think, some things that I say will be incorrect, but nonetheless, the attempt has to be made to better understand who we are, where we're at. And that's what he's trying to do here too, although he has far more information and he's kind of telling us what's going to come to pass. The alternative is capitulation to complexity, the admission that no sense can be extracted from what is happening. The consequent triumph of ignorance exacts its own tribute in the form of unstable and reactive policies, the substitution of slogans for thought. That's been the human, certainly the American, condition for a number of decades now. The rigid adherence to generalized formulas made in another age and in response to circumstances that are different in essence from our own, even if superficially similar. And I think that's such an important thing there too. The rigid adherence to generalized formulas made in another age. I think our human life is now planned and we just go from school, go to work 40 hours a week, in a drone-like existence, and then go plop down on your couch and watch television and just download the program that you're supposed to download and regurgitate. This is the, and then die when you're 65, when you're done producing, when you're done being a taxpayer, get off of planet Earth. That's the algorithm that they want to have in place, and we're getting very, very close to that. Today, the most industrially advanced countries are beginning to emerge from the industrial stage of their development. They are entering an age in which technology and especially electronics, hence my neologism means new word, hence my neologism, technotronic, are increasingly becoming the principal determinants of social change, altering the mores, the social structure, the values, and the global outlook of society. And precisely because today change is so rapid and so complex, it is perhaps more important than ever before that our conduct of foreign affairs be guided by a sense of history. And to speak of history in this context is to speak simultaneously of the past and the future. So we're going to get into some characteristics of what the emerging era is. During the classical era of international politics, weapons, communications, economics, and ideology were all essentially national in scope. I'd say probably even smaller than nationally. With the invention of modern artillery, weaponry required national arsenals and standing armies. In more recent times, it could be effectively and rapidly deployed by one nation against the frontiers of another. Communications, especially since the invention of the steam engine and the resulting age of railroads, reinforced national integration by making it possible to move people and goods across most nations in a period of time rarely exceeding 2 days. National economies, frequently resting on autarkic principles, autarkic means economic independence and self-sufficiency, national economies frequently resting on autarkic principles, stimulated both the awareness and the development of collective vested interest protected by tariff walls. Nationalism so personalized community feelings that the nation became an extension of the ego. And I'd say today, nationalism is very much an extension of the ego. And as we attach ourselves to America, if you will, if you're an American or wherever you happen to be, you attach yourself to your nation. And there's nothing inherently wrong. In fact, it's a good thing to love your country. That's not a bad thing at all. But what's happening is that these men have subverted America, have subverted our way of life so thoroughly, and that the propaganda is actually becoming false, right? It's attaching us to actually an evil and evil doings that the American military has been, going around the world for the last several decades and wreaking havoc. And we are just simply propagandized into accepting that. And we attach ourselves to it because we love ourselves. And thus, nationalism becomes an extension of the ego of ourselves. All four factors mentioned above are becoming global. Weapons of total destructive power can be applied at any point on the globe in a matter of minutes, in less time, in fact, than it takes for the police in a major city to respond to an emergency call. The entire globe is closer reach and touch than a middle-sized European power was to its own capital 50 years ago. Transnational ties are gaining in importance, while the claims of nationalism, though still intense, are nonetheless becoming diluted. This change, naturally, has gone furthest in the most advanced countries, but no country is now immune to it. The consequence is a new era, an era of the global political process. Yet though this process is global, real unity of mankind remains remote. Of course, I mean, we're probably less united than ever before. The contemporary world is undergoing a change in many respects similar to that prompted by the earlier appearance of large population centers. The growth of such centers weakened intimate and direct lines of authority and contributed to the appearance of many conflicting and cross-cutting allegiances. A typical city dweller identifies himself simultaneously with a variety of groups, occupational, religious, leisure, political, and only rarely operates in an environment that is exclusively dominated by a single system of values and a unilinear, personal commitment. American metropolitan politics are typically messy. Special interest and pressure groups, ethnic communities, political organizations, religious institutions, major industrial or financial forces, and even the criminal underworld interact in a pattern that simultaneously includes continuous limited warfare and accommodation. Global polities are acquiring some analogous characteristics. I'd say so. Nations of different sizes and developmentally in different historical epochs interact, creating friction, variable patterns of accommodation, and changing alignments. While the formal rules of the game maintain the illusion that it is played only by those players called states, and when war breaks out, the states become the only significant players, short of war, the game is truly played on a much more informal basis with much more mixed participation. Absolutely, this is very important to understand. What's happening now, it's March of 2023 when I'm recording this episode. We have the United States and backing Ukraine against what appears to be Russia. Now, most people, that's where it ends. You have Vladimir Putin and then you have Joe Biden and, you know, some other little states in between. And they're all talking and people just like, you know, think that this is all the players involved. Just states. And that is absolutely the furthest thing from the truth. In fact, that's a very childish way of understanding the world. And that's how they want you to understand the world, is in a very childish way. We continue. Some states possess overwhelming power. Others, the mini states, are overshadowed by multi-million dollar international corporations and major banks and financial interests. And that's the big one, obviously, major banks. You can check out the last four episodes. Transnational organizations of religious or ideological character and the emerging international institutions that in some cases represent the interests of minor players, for example, the UN, or in other cases mask the power of the major ones, for example, the Warsaw Pact or CETO. So, I mean, this is, of course, to people that watch this show, I'm sure you're very familiar with this, but I think there was a study, I forget the woman who gave a great presentation on this, talking about how of the 200 major financial or like just powerful entities in the world, it's only like 46 of them or 60 of them or something that are actual nations. And so you have businesses, you know, like Coca-Cola or, you know, whoever, insert business here, Apple, you know, that are actually far more powerful than most nations, in fact, right? Then when you consider international banking cabal, it really sits at the top of this heap. The international banking cabal runs Russia, runs the United States, runs Ukraine, runs all these things. So what that means is what you're seeing on television in terms of Putin versus Biden, Putin versus Zelensky, et cetera, is manufactured. It is a drama to create crisis, to create more poverty, and to bring us further, and to kill people, certainly to kill people. I mean, they've they've accomplished that pretty well with the injections, the C-19 injections, of course. But, you know, world wars are another way of killing lots of people as well. So there's a lot of goals involved, but it is manufactured by the technocrats for the financial dominating powers. So what is the Technotronic Society, which we're heading into? And again, keep in mind that this book, 1970, was when it was published. So, you know, over five decades ago when he was writing this stuff. we'll talk about, too, how much of this has come to pass. The transformation that is now taking place, especially in America, is already creating a society increasingly unlike its industrial predecessor. The post-industrial society is becoming a technotronic society, a society that is shaped culturally, psychologically, socially, and economically by the impact of technology and electronics, particularly in the area of computers and communications. And this is so absolutely 100% true. Where would we be without the internet? Where would we be without television? Who would we be? Who would you be without those things? We'd be very different people, would we not? And so one of the strongest points in this book is that this emergence of this new technology actually ushers in the emergence of new ideologies. And actually, I don't know why I didn't mark this section out in this book to actually read his own words, because it is truly, to me, the maybe the best point he makes is that when we had the Industrial Revolution, it coincided with the emergence of a new ideology. That new ideology was Marxism, and Marxism certainly took over much of the globe and certainly influenced everyone on the globe, I would say. Everyone that had exposure to modern ways of living, anyway. And now we have this emergence of this technotronic age with electricity, television and electronic gadgets and computers and these type of things. And that is also witnessing the emergence of a new ideology, is it not? The ideology of scientific rationalism, of the atheism, and certainly scientism have become quite prevalent. And certainly COVID-19 and people succumbing so easily to that propaganda wouldn't happen unless we were already very much a scientism believing people. We just follow what the experts say. And this is all done on purpose with intent to control. And so this new ideology is emerging as well with the onset of the technotronic era. And he's saying it influences every aspect of humanity. Our psychology, our value system certainly is highly influenced by the television and these things. The industrial process is no longer the principal determinant of social change, altering the mores, the social structure, and the values of society. In the industrial society, technical knowledge was applied primarily to one specific end, the acceleration and improvement of production techniques. Social consequences were a later byproduct of this paramount concern. In the technotronic society, scientific and technical knowledge, in addition to enhancing production capabilities, quickly spills over to affect almost all aspects of life directly. Accordingly, both the growing capacity for the instant calculation of the most complex interactions and the increasing availability of biochemical means of human control augment the potential scope of consciously chosen direction, and thereby also the pressures to direct, to choose, and to change. Now, who is he talking about here? Who has, first of all, the means available to control humans, the biochemical means? Who has that? You don't have that. I don't have that. So to whom is he writing this, right? And so it's, again, this is the forked tongue type of thing we're talking about here. He's saying it behooves them, the other technocrats, to now choose the direction that humanity is going to go, how they're going to certainly, outside of our will, human will, again, they're removing the individual capacity to choose and direct his own life, and they're going to do it for us. And now they're saying they even have, in 1970, have means of biochemical control. Some important characteristics of the Technotronic Society. The issue of political equality of the sexes gives way to a struggle for the sexual equality of women. In the industrial society, woman, the operator of machines, ceases to be physically inferior to the male, a consideration of some importance in rural life, and begins to demand her political rights. In the emerging technotronic society, automation threatens both males and females. Intellectual talent is computable. The pill encourages sexual equality, and women begin to claim complete equality. Certainly, that has already come to pass. There's a lot going on here in this sentence. So it threatens both males and females, certainly because of the fourth industrial revolution, which we are now seeing, where everything becomes automated, and it doesn't matter who you are, humans will become replaced by robots, and useless eaters, people who don't produce anything and only consume, will be wiped out. That is what we're witnessing. But there's also this a precursor to this here, and that's the apparent equality of the sexes. Now, this was something that Julian Huxley, who hopefully we'll get into some of his writings too, talked about, how one form of eugenics is to get the woman out of the home and into the workforce. Because not only do you double the taxable workforce, but you produce less children because the woman wants to be out in the workforce and having a career because that's what society tells her she ought to be doing. Because this technotronic era is giving her her new ideologies. Now, there's a huge flaw there because men don't get their, you know, fulfillment from their careers. You know, it's like, I don't define myself by how I make money. That's not who I am, right? Hopefully that's not who you are. That tends to be how we introduce ourselves. Hi, I'm so-and-so, and I am a letter carrier for the United States Postal Service, you know, like for example. So it's strange. It's a strange materialistic expression of this new ideological system that is emerging with the technotronic era. The newly enfranchised masses are organized in the industrial society by trade unions and political parties and unified by relatively simple and somewhat ideological programs. Moreover, political attitudes are influenced by appeals to nationalist sentiments communicated through the massive increase of newspapers employing naturally the reader's national language. In the technotronic society, the trend seems to be toward aggregating the individual support of millions of unorganized citizens who are easily within the reach of magnetic and attractive personalities and effectively exploiting the latest communication techniques to manipulate emotions and control reason. Reliance on television, and hence the tendency to replace language with imagery, which is international rather than national, and to include war coverage or scenes of hunger in places as distant as, for example, India, creates a somewhat more cosmopolitan means a universal citizen, more cosmopolitan, though highly impressionistic involvement in global affairs. So not only are we far past the equality of the sexes, we're now into animals are, you know, I'm an animal, I'm a dog, not a man, you know, that type of stuff. So that stuff is totally gone. But now we're into this highly impressionistic thing with this controlling reason. And the television, he's telling you they're using television and imagery to control thought and emotions. And now we're at a point where people think by thinking what the television tells them to think and then just regurgitating that they are somehow doing something, that they feel a sense of self-satisfaction, like they are living what they are supposed to be living. They are achieving the goals that the universe wants them to or whatever. And indeed they are. In a sense, they're doing the bidding of the technocrats and the financial elite, certainly. Economic power in the early phase of industrialization tends to be personalized either by great entrepreneurs like Henry Ford or bureaucratic industrial officials like Kaganovich or Mink in Solna's Poland. The tendency toward depersonalization of economic power is stimulated in the next stage by the appearance of a highly complex interdependence between governmental institutions, including the military, scientific establishments, and industrial organizations. As economic power becomes inseparably linked with political power, it becomes more invisible and the sense of individual futility increases. So a lot going on here. So you have this economic powers increase. They become invisible. I mean, this is a fact. You have this conglomeration of economic, political, and industrial forces, the World Economic Forum is exactly, that is exactly what the purpose of the World Economic Forum is. While they kind of operate in, again, that's what the name of the show is, Open Secrets. They operate in open secret fashion because the World Economic Forum publishes everything they do. Anyone on planet Earth can go to their website or go to their Twitter page or YouTube or wherever it is and look at and listen to exactly what they're telling you to do. But when we come on here and tell you what they're saying, we're conspiracy theorists. Because that's not what the mainstream media is telling them, because everyone is kept on this very low operating frequency. In fact, they're automatons by and large. And so you have this people, you know, being subject to the language and emotional and reason control from the television. And the language is being replaced by imagery, as I mentioned, which is a totally controlled and produced imagery, which then replaces the thoughts in humans' head, which for all intents and purposes replaces humanity, because someone simply regurgitating what television is telling them to do is not their own self. They didn't come to those conclusions for themselves. They're not creating anything of their own. So it's very interesting characteristics that Zbigniew Brzezinski was talking about of the Technotronic Era, which he called over five decades ago. Eventually, these changes and many others, including some that more directly affect the personality and quality of the human being himself, what is he talking about here, will make the technotronic society as different from the industrial as the industrial was from the agrarian. And just as the shift from an agrarian economy and feudal politics toward an industrial society and political systems based on individuals' emotional identification with the nation-state gave rise to contemporary international politics, so the appearance of the technotronic society reflects the onset of a new relationship between man and his expanded global reality. In fact, they want you in the metaverse as soon as possible. Just get your butt in there. Just become virtual you, sit on your couch in the material world and just live in this virtual existence and never do anything. That's how they want you to interact with this new global political system. Life seems to lack cohesion in this new tectonic society. Life seems to lack cohesion as environment rapidly alters and human beings become increasingly manipulable and malleable. Everything seems more transitory and temporary. External reality more fluid than solid, the human being more synthetic than authentic. Even our senses perceive an entirely novel reality, one of our own making, but nevertheless, in terms of our sensations, quite real. Now here, who is he talking about as our own making? To me, it's that forked tongue aspect we're talking about here. He's saying the technocrats are making this new reality because it's, If you are born into a system where you're plopped down in front of a television from the age of one, in front of an iPad or whatever, and you're just consuming that for your life, you are not you. You're living according to their plan. Your value systems, everything, what you think about, what you like, it's all from them. So it's certainly not of your own making at that point. So I believe that he's talking about the technocratic control of humans. More important, there is already widespread concern about the possibility of biological and chemical tampering with what has until now been considered the immutable essence of man. Human conduct, some argue, can be predetermined and subjected to deliberate control. And we're actually going to get a lot more into this in the next episode of this. Man of Open Secrets, that is. Man is increasingly acquiring the capacity to determine the sex of his children, to affect through drugs the extent of their intelligence, and to modify and control their personalities. Speaking of a future at most only decades away, an experimenter in intelligence control asserted, "I foresee the time when we shall have the means and therefore inevitably the temptation to manipulate the behavior and intellectual functioning of all the people through environmental and biochemical manipulation of the brain." And the people of this ilk are consumed with the idea of controlling human behavior. They are indeed psychopaths, right? Very first episode of Open Secrets, we talked about that. The behaviorism itself, started by Watson, in his first or second paper on the subject, talked about they intend to get to a point where they can control totally human behavior. Now these, so every, you know, branch of science, the neurochemists want to control human behavior through neurochemistry. The behaviorists want to control it through controlling environment, and then you just have a simple stimulus response reaction to everything that they put in your environment, thus they control your behavior. Now, you know, we now have the advent of these, you know, so-called inoculations against, you know, COVID-19 that have new technologies that are proving adept at altering our genetics. So there are certainly the ways of altering human life where it was advanced in 1970, and it's certainly hitting new highs as time has passed. The general effect on communication, another very important thing, actually. But while our immediate reality is being fragmented, global reality increasingly absorbs the individual, involves him, and even occasionally overwhelms him. Not just occasionally, frequently overwhelms him. Communications are the obvious, already much discussed, immediate cause. The changes wrought by communications and computers make for an extraordinarily interwoven society whose members are in continuous and close audio-visual contact. And I say it's, but it's far more impersonal. Because, I mean, if you look at someone's Facebook page, you kind of get a sense of who they are, and then you see them in person, and it's like, oh, I don't want to talk to you because of some post you put on Facebook. You know? We have a more digital experience rather than a personal experience with other members of the human species. Constantly interacting, instantly sharing the most intense social experiences, and prompted to increased personal involvement in even the most distant problems. You internalize the stuff you see on television. So if you see war happening in Iraq or, you know, where, it doesn't matter where, you internalize it. It has an emotional impact upon you, even though before television, you wouldn't have even known about it. The new generation no longer defines the world exclusively on the basis of reading, either of ideologically structured analyses or of extensive descriptions. It also experiences and senses it vicariously through audiovisual communications. This form of communicating reality is growing more rapidly, especially in the advanced countries, than the traditional written medium, and it provides the principal source of news for the masses. And here's a quote. By 1985, distance will be no excuse for delayed information from any part of the world to the powerful urban nerve centers that will mark the major concentrations of the people on Earth. Global telephone dialing that in the more advanced states will include instant visual contact and a global television satellite system that will enable some states to invade private homes in other countries will create unprecedented global intimacy. So what do you think he's talking about there? Of course, he's talking about the internet, but we'll get there because he actually predicts the internet in this book. He doesn't predict it. He knows it's coming. He's helping usher in the internet. But that's what they're talking about there. And truly, the ability of instantaneous communication, he makes his case, actually renders nations kind of meaningless. Because what we already talked about, you have the emotional impact on the American citizen through television imagery, you know, of someone in Uganda or wherever there's war, wherever they choose to show you, you know. So you have this instant communication of the treachery that's happening outside of your borders, which never would have happened in the past. And so there's instant communications between, you know, the rulers of our nations as well. And so we are truly becoming a more international citizens. These mediums could be used for very good things. Instead, they're being used to manipulate us. But nonetheless, the effect on communication is, as he laid out, you know, more impersonal, and certainly instantaneous video communication definitely changed and has changed our way of life greatly. Getting to the general effect on science and knowledge. The science explosion, the most rapidly expanding aspect of our entire reality, growing more rapidly than population, industry, and cities, intensifies rather than reduces these feelings of insecurity. It is simply impossible for the average citizen and even for men of intellect to assimilate and meaningfully organize the flow of knowledge for themselves. It's impossible now. In every scientific field, complaints are mounting that the torrential outpouring of published reports, scientific papers, and scholarly articles, and the proliferation of professional journals make it impossible for individuals to avoid becoming either narrow-gauge specialists or superficial generalists. Now, this is a massive problem in science, but we don't see it as a problem in science. You know, I was learning all this stuff before I read any of this material. I was getting the sense for this, of the futility of science now, because I remember vividly, they were honoring one of the professors at the school I was at, her career, and one of the main achievements she had was she had over 100 scientific publications, and it just struck me as so backwards, because if you have 100 scientific publications, you put a career effort into that, how many of those publications translate to actually helping someone? The answer is zero. I mean, even Tony Fauci is the most published scientist, I think, out there right now. He is over, over 1,100 some publications, enormous. But even in his early career, he studied some obscure autoimmune disorder. They said he had 68 publications just on that autoimmune disorder. Now, if it were me that were studying this autoimmune disorder, if I made 68 publications on something, I was trying to answer something to solve the problem, and I had 68 bites at the apple, so to speak, and if I hadn't solved it by then, I would give up. I would say, I don't know what I would do. I wouldn't stick around for that long, though. I would try and solve it in one paper, right? That's what science should be aiming at, but that's not, because of what he's talking about here. Narrow gauge specialists. People are becoming hyper-specialized, and they are being rewarded for being hyper-specialized through a very nice salary, a nice position at a prestigious institution, and you get to lecture, you get to live in this ivory tower where you're no longer attached to reality, and you get to well compensated. And this is by design. It's to keep science hyper-specialized, and it's to keep it from actually solving problems. The sharing of new common perspectives thus becomes more difficult as knowledge expands. In addition, traditional perspectives, such as those provided by primitive myths, or more recently, by certain historically conditioned ideologies, can no longer be sustained. The threat of intellectual fragmentation posed by the gap between the pace and the expansion of knowledge and the rate of its assimilation raises a perplexing question concerning the prospects for mankind's intellectual unity. It has generally been assumed that the modern world, shaped increasingly by the industrial and urban revolutions, will be more homogeneous in its outlook. This may be so, but it could be the homogeneity of insecurity, of uncertainty, of intellectual anarchy. Exactly. The result, therefore, would not necessarily be a more stable environment. Absolutely not. Look at, do we have open, honest, intellectual debate in science anymore or in any field? Heck no, we don't. Absolutely not. So it is intellectual anarchy, but it's not. It's a ushered anarchy, a guided intellectual anarchy, certainly dominated by the rule by experts intellectual fallacy. You know, just follow what the expert says, and anyone that deviates from that is anathema, must be cast out, which is a precursor to actually killing the people that have those ideologies, by the way. That's the road we're on. This little section here, he just point out that he states again, this book, 1970, predicts the end. Doesn't predict it. He tells you it's coming. Roughly 65% of all world communications originate in this country. Moreover, the United States has been most active in the promotion of a global communication system by means of satellites, and it's pioneering in the development of a worldwide information grid. It is expected that such a grid will come into being by about 1975. Well, they're off by a couple decades there, but nonetheless. For the first time in history, the cumulative knowledge of mankind will be made accessible on a global scale, and it will be almost instantaneously available in response to demand. And that is exactly where we're at. That is the internet. Of course, because he was a technocrat that was ushering this in. I'm going to get into a little bit about nation states and the future of war. The nation state is a fundamental unit of man's organized life. As a fundamental unit of man's organized life has ceased to be the principal creative force. International banks and multinational corporations are acting and planning in terms that are far in advance of the political concepts of the nation state. We had mentioned how the World Economic Forum is. The purpose is to bring together the banks and the corporations and the nations as into one thing, one hegemonic global dominant system. And the World Economic Forum is just a front for this that is controlled by the banking elite. But as the nation state is gradually yielding its sovereignty, the psychological importance of the national community is rising. And the attempt to establish an equilibrium between the imperatives of the new internationalism and the need for a more intimate national community is the source of frictions and conflicts. The achievement of that equilibrium is being made more difficult by the scientific and technological innovations in weaponry. Okay, here's the classic excuse too, the Hegelian dialectic, if you will, is they always use nation states warring against each other, and he's going to say it's going to get nastier, and all these new technologies that are going to emerge that make it, you know, nations more effective at killing other, you know, other human beings, and therefore you must just have a one world government to be rid of all this. It is ironic to recall that in 1878, Frederick Engels, commenting on the Franco-Prussian War, proclaimed that weapons used have reached such a stage of perfection that further progress, which would have any revolutionary influence, is no longer possible. Not only have new weapons been developed, but some of the basic concepts of geography and strategy have been fundamentally altered. Space and weather control have replaced Suez or Gibraltar as key elements of strategy. Some people would call you a conspiracy theorist in 2023 for talking about what we're about to talk about here. Space and weather control have replaced Suez or Gibraltar as key elements of strategy. In addition to improved rocketry, multi-missiles, and more powerful and more accurate bombs, future developments may well include automated or manned space warships, deep-sea installations, chemical and biological weapons, death rays, and still other forms of warfare. Even the weather may be tampered with. These new weapons could either encourage expectations of one-sided, relatively inexpensive victory, permit proxy contests that will be decisive in their strategic political outcome but will be fought by only a few human beings, or even by robots in outer space, or simply create such mutual instability that the breakdown of peace will become inevitable in spite of man's rational recognition of the futility of war. In addition, it may be possible and tempting to exploit for strategic political purposes the fruits of research on the brain and on human behavior. Gordon J. F. MacDonald, a geophysicist specializing in problems of warfare, has written that accurately timed, artificially excited electronic strokes could lead to a pattern of oscillations that produce relatively high power levels over certain regions of the Earth. In this way, one could develop a system that would seriously impair the brain performance of very large populations in selected regions over an extended period. No matter how deeply disturbing the thought of using the environment to manipulate behavior for national advantages to some, the technology permitting such use will very probably develop within the next few decades. And absolutely it has. So in 1970, the United Nations had a treaty. So the member states of the United Nations signed a treaty wherein they agreed that they would not use weather warfare against each other. And I suggest you all check me on this, because in this treaty, they talked about you can't control, you know, droughts, you can't control storms, you can't even cause an earthquake in another nation. Now, if you told someone in the year 2023 that we have the ability to create earthquakes, some things, they would call you absolutely nuts. But in 1970, they were writing treaties that included that language in it, and they all agreed not to create earthquakes in other nations. So, you know, the simple low-lying stuff like chemtrails and basic weather modification is even beyond the pale for the vast majority of humanity, which is insane, because they just have to look in the sky some days. You can see it happening above you. We're being sprayed like bugs, you know. But Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, the president, when he was president, or maybe it was before he was president, but he gave a speech about weather warfare as the next plane of warfare, if you will. This is not a new thing. We're on Grand Forks Best Source because we are in a city called Grand Forks, located in North Dakota, 70 miles south of here, and there's this town called Fargo. There's a company in Fargo called Weather Modification Systems or Weather Modification Industry or something like that. So there's you know, corporations being made on controlling weather. There is nothing new about that, but it is an entirely novel concept to most people. There's also the HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, where they, you know, shoot electronic things into the ionosphere. I don't know the exact details of it, but there are published scientific papers on this subject. You know, none of this stuff is actual conspiracy theory. We are just kept totally in the dark about reality. Right. The evolution of perception via political systems. Here we go. With the growth in the West of man's ability to master his environment, secular rationalism emerged to challenge industrialized religion. Again, this is what I was talking about. There's this new ideology that is emerging that is plaguing most people, plaguing the atheism, the apathy, the scientism. That religious allegiance simultaneously rested on the narrowness and on the universalism of man's horizons. The narrowness derived from massive ignorance, illiteracy, and a vision confined to the immediate environment by limited communications. And I would say, bring it on, Zbigniew Brzezinski. I will debate you if he were still alive. I mean, now he knows the truth because he's, you know, dead. But it's, in fact, literacy and reading that actually brings people to religion. And truly flourishing of the intellect is in the true religion. The universalism was provided by the acceptance of the idea that man's destiny is essentially in God's hands and that the limited present is but a stepping stone to an unlimited future. Emerging secularism challenged both dimensions and in so doing required for the external projection of man's identity an intermediary focus of loyalty, something in between the immediate and the infinite. The nation state and nationalism were the responses. So here we see nationalism is replacing religion. And that's what would happen in the French Revolution, for example. All these things happening in the late 1770s, 1776, of course, is a big year. You have the emergence of this nationalism, this strong national identity, these new doctrines which replaced religion. Became more important to be a Frenchman than a Catholic, for example. The doctrine of sovereignty created the institutional basis for challenging the secular authority of established religion, and this challenge in turn paved the way for the emergence of the abstract conception of the nation-state. Sovereignty vested in the people, instead of sovereignty vested in the king, was the consummation of the process which, in the two centuries preceding the French and American revolutions, radically altered the structure of authority in the West and prepared the ground for a new dominant concept of reality, changing people's value system and perception of what is real. We went from the religious to very much a materialistic nation-state sense of reality. The nation-state became simultaneously the embodiment of personal commitments and the point of departure for analyzing reality. This development marked a new phase in man's political consciousness. Nationalism did not seek to direct the individual toward the infinite, but to activate the impersonal masses for the sake of immediately proximate goals. Paradoxically, these concrete goals were derived from the still intangible and transcendental, though new, object of worship, the nation. The nation became the source of ecstatic, lyrical affection, and it was this highly emotional relationship symbolized by the new anthems, flags, and heroes that served to energize the populace. The concrete goals took the form of massive preoccupation with frontiers, irredenta, brethren to be regained from foreign captivity, and more generally, the power and the glory of the state as the formal expression of the nation. The state thus became the institutional form for the new dominant belief with a monopolistic claim on the active dedication to it of man, now designated first and above all as the citizen. So you became a citizen of the United States of America, more importantly than a citizen of the Catholic Church or whichever religion, right? It was more important to be a man that was loyal to his state than to anything else. And thus... new propaganda was unveiled with the geared toward that end, to make you a citizen of your heart, like in your heart, the essence of your being is poured into this nationalist identity, which is a very important evolution because it destroys the old religious order. It has allowed the old religious orders to basically be removed from the face of planet Earth, which they've done. Today, the relationship of ideas to institutions is turbulent. Institutions resist ideas lest they lead to changes that undermine the institutions. And the exponents of ideas rebel against institutions because of the intellectual constraints said to be inherent in their existence. This development is part of the progressive secularization of our life. An important role in this process is played by the changed character of contemporary communications, which permits rapid dissemination of ideas and images and requires less reliance on an organized effort to proselytize. Today, more people are exposed to impressions that are both more fluid and more volatile than ever before. There is no longer the same need to challenge rigid and traditional taboos with alternative and more appealing visions, or to overcome social inertia with organized mobilization effort. All this puts institutionalized beliefs on the defensive. More and more, their efforts are designed to retain the positive loyalty of their adherents and to combat influences that are inimical to structured, formalized, and highly institutionalized beliefs. It's crazy how this is true. You think of the old institutionalized things, religion. In this book, he talks about communism as an institutionalized belief that is becoming outdated because in his eyes, Marxism is destroyed by the institutionalized form of it in the form of communism. And so all these institutionalized beliefs crumble, and what emerges from it is a person who's attached and identifies with very little, actually. Writing almost a century ago, Marx observed that, and this is a very important quote, up till now, it has been thought that the growth of the Christian myths during the Roman Empire was possible only because printing was not yet invented. Precisely the contrary. The daily press and the telegraph, which in a moment spread inventions over the whole earth, fabricate more myths, and the bourgeois cattle believe and enlarge upon them. In one day, so again, these things, the daily press and telegraph fabricate more myths in one day than could have formerly been done in a century. When to the press and telegraph is added the contemporary global role of radio and television, and to religion are added contemporary ideologies, Marx's observations become even more pertinent. So you have technocrats producing the images and language through television and radio that they wish the people to consume. And these things that they're consuming are myths, they're falsehoods. It creates a matrix-like system, a system that is real in a sense that people believe it and they live in their video game, sports ball, 40-hour work week, whatever, consume, alcohol, potato chips, lifestyle. It's a real in the sense that it's a thing that people are actually consuming, but it's not real in the sense that it is a manufactured way of life for you, and it is actually a very empty, vacuous, that's redundant, but way of life. It does, and it certainly is ushering in our own destruction. So this new communication techniques are being exploited to destroy us and destroy old institutionalized belief systems. Let's see, where am I at here? Descent and urban populations. Descent and urban populations. The problem of intellectual freedom, and how much intellectual freedom do we have? People who think they are intellectually free, again, are just regurgitating what the television tells them to, or school, the controlled education system and the controlled image coming from the television are the two major pillars of human mind and behavioral control. The problem of intellectual freedom prompts considerations that are more directly concerned with politics and ideology. It is impossible to judge the extent of fundamental unorthodox dissent in the Soviet Union of the late 1960s and early 1970s. In the late 1968, two successive issues of the magazine Problems of Communism were devoted to the underground writings, petitions, protests, and appeals of dissenting Soviet intellectuals. They made for remarkable and profoundly moving reading, as did some separately published documents in which Ukrainian intellectuals protested the suppression of their country. These publications indicated the existence of an active and articulate group of intellectuals, largely concentrated in Moscow and Leningrad, composed in some cases of the offspring of the Soviet political elite, but more often of the children of prominent communists who had perished under Stalin. Though a number of these dissenters have been tried both privately and publicly in Moscow and Leningrad, they have not been deterred from protesting, and they did so again at grave personal risk following the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia. Now we're undergoing different type of censorship, which I've talked about a few times, I'm sure, but it's censorship of ideas. I talked about in this episode already, censorship of ideas, which is a censorship, a precursor to censorship of the people that have those ideas, which is the killing of those ideas, people, which is a decade away, I'm guessing, you know, something like that, if we're, the current trajectory keeps going. The majority of this next little part is fascinating to me. The majority of the Soviet Union's urban population, only one generation removed from their rural setting, are characterized by a social orthodoxy based on a rather simplistic internalized ideology and by a sense of satisfaction in their recent social advancement. Moreover, in its social origins and ways of thinking, the party is closer to the masses than the masses are to the intellectuals. And so they, all these people, you had all these individuals move off the farms and move into big cities, and that's exactly what's happening across the globe. The last time I looked, and it was probably a year and a half ago, it was a stunning statistic on how many people are moving into cities. And the city lifestyle is it's not how we're meant to live. I'll just put it that way. It is the concrete jungle type of thing. When there's these famous experiments from the early days of the National Institute of Mental Health, when they put all these rats and let them kind of do their own thing, but essentially living really in close proximity, and they killed each other more frequently. There's more, you know, starvation and all these things because it's a less free, more confined lifestyle. And people are living and moving in droves into these cities. And it also ushers in, the people that move there, have a more selfish lifestyle, more self-indulgent tendency, and they think that somehow by putting themselves into a large city, they can kind of dilute who they are because they don't know who they are, and they just become one with the movement of the masses, which is very much a materialism and self-indulgent lifestyle. And so there's no need to massacre people out, you know, like the Soviet Union was doing to get people to move into urban centers anymore. The propaganda has achieved that very, very well. Now we're going to talk about cybernetics and technotronic communism. The example of Ulbricht's East Germany, it's Walter Ulbricht, who was the head of the Socialist Unity Party and head of state in East Germany from 1960 to 1973. East Germany, of course, was the communist part of Germany. The example of Ulbricht's East Germany may become particularly relevant, though in Romania, explorations of the scientific revolution's significance have led some communists to suggest that this revolution requires a new theoretical framework based on the principle of universality. Ulbricht has attempted to combine scientific innovation with strict adherence to the Leninist-Stalinist ideological tradition. Political leadership has remained highly centralized, and ideological dissent has been firmly suppressed. At the same time, Ulbricht, perhaps more than any other communist leader, has emphasized that the development of the socialist system, above all the implementation of the economic system as a whole, is to a growing extent a matter of scientific leadership. We orient ourselves on the conscious scientific control of complex processes and systems by the people and for the people. We make use of cybernetics in this sense. And cybernetics is the science of control and communications in the animal and machine using physiology of the nervous system to produce automatic control. So you are just an economic unit. It's a totally impersonal thing. You have no feelings, no desires, no soul of your own. You are just a piece of meat that is to be used for gain, for profit, for economic growth. And cybernetics is being used to control you, to make you more machine-like. During the second half of the 1960s, East German leadership made an intense effort to rationalize economic management in order to combine lower-level initiative with an effective system of controls and coordination. The Seventh Party Congress set itself the task of developing a general conception of the relations between the various part systems with the economic system as a whole. More than any other communist country, East Germany utilized cybernetics, operational research, and electronic data processing. 2 years later, at the April 1969 Central Committee plenum, Politburo member Kurt Hager proudly reported, and he repeatedly used this formula, that East Germany was not only ideologically sound, but correctly programmed. East Germany was correctly programmed. Stunning. In line with this correct programming, the party has emphasized the importance of expertise among its members, and the educational system has been reformed in order to link science closely with industry. And they talk about in here about how essentially the university is going to be used as a tool in, of course, cybernetics, and that the local economic needs, local industrial needs, will be reflected at what is taught in the schools, in the universities, excuse me, and then again, just automating everything. And so, you know, do you think the data that they got from East Germany just went away, that they're not applying it? I mean, this same principle is, look at the ideologies as taught in American schools. What is taught in American universities is the communist, Marxist ideologies. And look what's happened to America. It's been destroyed for all intents and purposes. And there's even the aspect of this, you know, let's have the local universities produce people with special skill sets for the industry around it. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, except when it becomes the end in and of itself, when that becomes the function of the university, is to you know, hypersexualize, addict to whatever they can addict you to, and then make you a robotic meat piece of meat that is there just to perform a function in the economy. That is what this university system has produced. And that's because of the experiments that were happening in the USSR and all the way through East Germany, which sounded like they got, you know, the correct programming of their citizens. Now, we shift our view towards America and what's happening in the United States of America in the late 60s, and then the projections for what is to come. The phase, he's talking about the phase of American dominance, the phase, he makes this point too, which is an absolutely, in my opinion, correct observation, that America was truly the first global imperialist empire, and kind of still is, right? We have military bases all over the world. The things that America exports, our culture, our, you know, Hollywood, our love, you know, our love of entertainment, our love of sports, certainly the scientific advancements that America produces is also exported. Because Donald J. Trump was for the shot, the world became for the shot. You know, I mean, everything that gets rolled on America, it gets stamp of approval from the United States, the world accepts it more freely than if it got the stamp of approval from China, for example, right? But this phase of, he's already talking about in 1970, the phase of American dominance is coming to an end. The social blinders that have made America unaware of its shortcomings have been ripped off, and the painful awareness of America's society's lingering inadequacy has been rendered more acute by the intensity and pace of change. And here I think he Big New kind of contradicts himself a few times in this book. And here's one where I think he's contradicting himself, because he's, I think these, the social blinders are ripped off intentionally by the people supplying the imagery, right? They were exaggerating the weaknesses of America in the late 1960s. They were saying, hey, focus on the racism problem in this country. Focus on all these negative things in this country, and let's exploit that. So that's what was going on. In a word, America is undergoing a new revolution whose distinguishing feature is that it simultaneously maximizes America's potential as it unmasks its obsolescence. And this is the destruction of America. It's maximizing its potential in terms of export, this global imperialist system, exporting all these American values and American culture and American technology, certainly, across the globe. That's maximizing America's potential there. But we are becoming obsolete. Certainly now, the stated goal of the World Economic Forum and its the Great Reset commercial, check it out again, one of the things it says is America will no longer be the world superpower. That is by design. We are moving all of us in this globe into a one world system where America and the culture that is very much wealthy relative to the rest will be brought down a peg or two or three or four. The third American Revolution is even harder to define, for we are now in the middle of it and thus cannot be certain of its outcome. In one respect, however, it is easier to identify than the second, for its impact and its effect are more concentrated in time. The Third Revolution began gathering momentum after World War II with massive entrance into colleges of ex-GIs, with a concomitant explosion in higher learning and the growing acceptance of the social primacy of education, with the union of national power and modern science crowned by harnessing of nuclear energy, and the federal government emerging as a major sponsor of scientific investigation, with the sudden birth of rapid continental communications ranging from the world's most modern and developed highway system through rapid air passenger transport to a uniquely effective instant transcontinental telephone system, and finally to a nationwide television intimacy, with the transformation in managerial techniques wrought by the appearance of computers and other electronic devices that conquer complexity, distance, and even the diffusion of authority, and with the fading of industry as the most important source of employment for most Americans. Prompted by technology, and particularly electronics, the Third Revolution is changing the basic institutions and values of American society, and, as was also the case with the preceding revolutions, it is encountering resistance, stimulating violence, and causing anxiety and stirring hope. Hope for whom? For the Zbigniew Brzezinskis of the world. In the process, it is creating three Americas in one. There is the emerging new America, symbolized by the new complexes of learning, research, and development that link institutions of higher learning with society and create unprecedented opportunities for innovation and experimentation, in addition to sparking increased interest in the fine arts and culture, and is evidenced by new museums and art centers. We went into the CIA and the Cultural Cold War in that book. I think it's like episode 6, something like that. About how the arts were even controlled, culture was controlled through intelligence agencies and guys like Henry Luce, who was the president, who was a Skull and Bones man, and who was the president of Time, who brought Jackson Pollock and that garbage to the world. So we could have, you know, stimulated interest in fine art, actual fine art, but and certainly the scientific developments. I'm focused on medical science, you know, that's my background, but, you know, human health is suffering worse than it's ever done. You know, there's more disease is absolutely exploding, and all different kinds of disease are exploding because they're first and foremost are new diseases that are emerging, and they are man-made pharmaceutical created diseases. So all of these things could be used for good, but actually are being used to exploit us further. Technotronic America is in the electronics laboratories and learning centers of the centers of learning around along Route 128 surrounding Boston. It is in the academic scientific conglomerates around Los Angeles and San Francisco, and it is in the new frontier industries. The suburban middle class increasingly gravitates towards this America, though frequently resenting its scientism and nostalgically yearning for more community and stability. Scientism, I mean, they used to resent its scientism. Now people have fully embraced scientism, you know, which is the belief that everything that comes out of science is the truth and is worthy of our adoration, and we ought to bend the knee and pray to science. The new America is only now taking shape. Today, not only does a child face a radical rupture with the past, but he must be trained for an unknown future. And this task confronts the entire society as well. And I say, trained by whom? Who is going to be doing the training? I say here, this was completed by the 90s. Yeah, we, again, this new age of television represents a complete rupture with the past. It's all about the immediate execution of self-pleasure in any way, shape, or form, mainly driven by staring into the boob tube, you know, and getting your indoctrination that way, and just having fun. So, and not caring about the past. So the complete rupture with the past is already well past, and we're being trained for an uncertain future. But the training, it's really not that uncertain to us, because it's going to look like, you know, a virtual age where people, the human is actually totally ineffective, without skill, without understanding, without the ability to articulate ideas, without the ability to have new ideas and to say something truly novel to the world and to give new creativity to the world. All of this stuff is, and like research, there's the term research, you know, like you're told is you gotta, it's called research because you find something, then you gotta find it again and again and again to make sure it's real. But in my opinion, research is, we're already discovering things that are already known. you know, where there's nothing new that the everyday Joe in a lab is going to discover anymore. The real findings have already been found and discovered. So this, you know, we're being trained for total and absolute totalitarian system where humans are fully robotic. The current transformation also poses profound philosophical issues concerning the very essence of social existence, since it is largely derived from an unprecedented expansion of scientific power over both man's environment and man himself. Studies of change cumulatively reinforce the picture of a society undergoing a far-reaching, technologically induced revolution. And to me, in my opinion, and we'll talk more about behaviorism in the next episode of this, but behavior, control of human behavior, is the prevailing science of our age, because we are being totally automated. And that's what he talks about, power over man, both man's environment and man himself. We're basically almost totally there. The facts reflecting change in America are familiar and therefore need not be related in detail. There is, first of all, the massive expansion in the sector of society concerned with science and knowledge. And most people know this, but I wrote this. It's over 90% of all the PhDs, the doctorates that have ever existed, are alive right now. So the PhD degree is, for all intents and purposes, now worthless. It doesn't really mean much anymore. This means a scientific growth more rapid than that in other sectors in the number of scientists, college students, and of course the institutions that nurture them. As a result, the university has emerged as the creative core of the massive learning communications complex, the source of much domestic and international strategic innovation. In social prestige and influence, the university is displacing the equivalent institutions of the more traditional America, the church and big business. Absolutely, that to me is true. Your everyday Joe who has the ideology of the technotronic era, they say you have to go to college, you have to go to college. And if you don't go to college, they look down upon you. You know, you become worthless or less successful. You know, they have some, you know, judgment against you if you don't go to college, because you're supposed to. The emphasis on science and learning goes hand in hand with the rationalization of techniques and the introduction of new teaching, managerial computing, and communications devices, which are altering established practices and changing the methods used to store and retrieve accumulated knowledge. A national information grid that will integrate existing electronic data banks is already being developed to pool the nation's accumulated knowledge. Though American educational theorists disagree about the degree to which the educational systems can adapt the new techniques, the debates reveal the extent to which technical assimilation rather than philosophical issues dominate their thinking. And to me, that's absolutely true. Most people in college or any education is simply just, you know, memorize and repeat, memorize and repeat, memorize and repeat. There's no actual philosophical intimation and discourse and true understanding that is derived from the education system anymore. Contemporary business puts a similar premium on knowledge and the rapid adaption of new techniques. This requires the pooling of resources and collective organizational efforts, the frequent and systematic retraining of top personnel, and a close tie with the centers of knowledge. Linear programming, a systems approach to problems, coordinated teamwork, and a highly sophisticated attitude towards human relations and labor psychology are becoming the dominant features of managerial processes. According to Lawrence Apley, the chairman of the American Management Association, the number of managers involved in professional management societies and working with management consultants has risen from 10,000 in 1948 to over 600,000 in 1962. I'm going to say the bureaucracy expands. Operationally, business less and less resembles a political hierarchy or a personal fiefdom. It is increasingly similar to a systematic scientific undertaking that not only produces what is known, but systematically seeks to explore what is to come. In summarizing the social transformation wrought by technology, Daniel Bell listed five key areas of change. One, by producing more goods at less cost, technology has been the chief engine of raising the living standards of the world. Two, technology has created a new class hitherto unknown in society of the engineer and technician. It's also created the technocrat class, which he doesn't talk about here, which is essentially almost at the apex of the pyramid of domination of the world. It's the one right under, which serves the financial masters. And three, technology has created a new definition of rationality, a new mode of thought, which emphasizes functional relations and the quantitative, what we we can measure scientifically. And four, the revolutions in transportation and communications as a consequence of technology have created new economic interdependencies and new social interactions. Definitely true. And five, aesthetic perceptions, particularly of space and time, have been radically altered. And this I talked about in greater detail in the culture industry episodes. And I think personally, the first episode of the culture industry is my best episode of Open Secrets. I think it's an excellent episode. But the aestheticization of reality is the more you see things through technology, specifically the television, you see a, you know, whatever scenario you see on television hundreds and thousands of times, it influences what you experience when you go out and actually see these things in the real world. To these should be added the new sense of self-awareness induced by society's increasing ability to see itself in the mirror provided by television. Again, the image of yourself you see in the television is a totally produced image that they want you to acclimatize to and to take in as who you are. Buttressed by increased reliance on statistical analysis and intensified by a systematic preoccupation with managing not only the present, but the future. And it is the technocrats, that are using the television and all these new technologies to manage and control us. This next little section is actually a footnote by a man named Conrad Lorenz in his book called On Aggression, which was published in 1966, which is fascinating, which perhaps we'll do one day. I doubt it, but it's nonetheless an awesome read. Talking about human condition and how humans can be manipulated when they reach a certain age of development. During and shortly after puberty, human beings have an indubitable tendency to loosen their allegiance to all traditional rights and social norms of their culture, allowing conceptual thought to cast doubt on their value and to look around for new and perhaps more worthy ideals. There probably is, at that time of life, a definite sensitive period for a new object fixation, much as in the case of the object fixation found in animals and called imprinting. If at that crucial time of life, old ideas prove fallacious under critical scrutiny and new ones fail to appear, the result is complete aimlessness, the utter boredom which characterizes the young delinquent. If, on the other hand, the clever demagogue, like Conrad Lorenz, like Zbigniew Brzezinski, if the clever demagogue, well-versed in the dangerous art of producing supranormal stimulus situations, gets hold of young people at the susceptible age, he finds it easy to guide their object fixation in a direction subservient to his political aims. So if someone can control the perception of people going through puberty, teenagers, I wonder what kind of tool that would be, they can change their life forever and bring them under their domination, political domination. At the post-pubertal age, some human beings seem to be driven by an overpowering urge to espouse a cause and failing to find a worthy one may become fixated on astonishingly inferior substitutes. They become fixated on astonishingly inferior substitutes. Why? Because they become fixated on a provided supranormal stimulus, above normal stimulation. Now, the television and computer and these things are, that's all they produce is supranormal stimulus. And the term supranormal stimulus, I can't remember the man's name. It was in like the 40s, I want to say. And he did an experiment where a bird laid an egg. And this man left that egg that this bird laid. And then he put an egg next to it that was shiny or had all these, you know, jewels on it or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was made to look more attractive to the bird and subvert the instincts of this bird. And guess what? It happened. The bird would sit on this more beautiful egg and let the egg that it actually laid go to waste and not take care of it because it was a supranormal stimulus. Now, lots and lots of literature have gone into the supranormal stimulus called pornography. It is very much an unreal scenario provided to you free of charge at a moment's notice, everyone. And it's so important to understand this because if you, during puberty, children are exposed to pornography, which they all are, the average age of pornography exposure is like 12 or something. It's getting less and less the more cell phones go into the hands of young kids, they'll become disillusioned with the mores and the value system that they were raised on, and they won't be able to find an adequate substitute. So they will espouse a cause become fixated on the supernormal summons, which is astonishingly inferior to the value system on which they were raised. And if a political demagogue, and we're talking about here the Zbigniew Brzezinski, the guys behind the scenes who provide the cult of personality, like the Barack Obama or the Donald Trump or whomever, they provide these manufactured people to, you know, subvert us and to take our creative, our energies and shuffle them into this and say, this person's, you know, flashy on the television saying all these right things, I'm going to follow them. I mean, every step of our life, if you're sitting in front of the television, is guided and controlled. Your thought, therefore your behavior, is controlled by guys like this. Very important little section there. Only a couple more sections, folks. The controlled and directed America. Now, to be fair, this section is in a lot of other scenarios where Zbigniew Brzezinski says this could play out, this could happen, you know, this other thing could happen. But here we talk about another threat, less overt but no less basic, confronts liberal democracy. More directly linked to the impact of technology, it involves the gradual appearance of a more controlled and directed society. Such a society would be dominated by an elite whose claim to political power would rest on allegedly superior scientific know-how. Unhindered by the restraints of traditional liberal values, this elite would not hesitate to achieve its political ends by using the latest modern techniques for influencing public behavior and keeping society under close surveillance and control. This is exactly what's happening. This is, Bertrand Russell talked about this. We talked about the impact of science on society. I think it was episode 3 of Open Secrets, but I mean, this is where we're at. This is the scenario we find ourselves in. Under such circumstances, the scientific and technological momentum of the country would not be reversed, but would actually feed on the situation it exploits. The emergence of a large dominant party alongside the more narrowly focused and more intensely doctrinaire groupings on the right and the left could accelerate the trend toward such technological managerialism. We're enduring technological managerialism. Such a large dominant party would combine American society's quest for stability with its historical affinity for innovation. Relying on scientific growth to produce the means for dealing with social ills, it would tap the nation's intellectual talent for broad target planning and exploit the existence of doctrinaire groups by using them as social barometers and as a source of novel ideas. So these guys are constantly monitoring us, especially through social media. Everyone puts all their thoughts and feelings on social media now. Groups put their thoughts and feelings on social media. And if there is actually a novel idea, these guys monitoring, like, hey, well, that's actually a really good idea. First of all, we got to censor them. And then we got to use this idea for our own ends. Persisting social crisis, the emergence of a charismatic personality, the cult of personality, and the exploitation of mass media to obtain public confidence would be the stepping stones in the piecemeal transformation of the United States into a highly controlled society. This is all we do. How base is the political discourse recently, in the last few decades? There's very little intellect involved in anything that these people are saying. We're certainly not electing, the philosopher king, as Plato put it, you know, into office. And the president of the United States of America has been under domination of the banking system for a very long time. A book that we will not get into because it would be like 9 episodes long is called Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. But in it, he details how already in 1920, J.P. Morgan had the Republican and Democrat nominee for president, it was Cox and Harding, in his back pocket. That was over 100 years ago, folks. Their control has gotten finer and more powerful in the last century. It certainly hasn't gotten weaker. And they've been using sciences and all these technologies. And they direct the creative forces of the American populace, not just the populace of the world, really, so that we build our prison system. And then we love the prison system we're building. We love our servitude. Change in educational procedures and philosophy should also be accompanied by parallel changes in the broader national process by which values are generated and disseminated. Given America's role as a world disseminator of new values and techniques, this is both a national and a global obligation. Yet no other country has permitted its mass culture, taste, daily amusement, and most important, the indirect education of its children to be almost exclusively the domain of private business and advertising, or permitted both standards of taste and the intellectual content of culture to be defined largely by a small group of entrepreneurs located in one metropolitan center. He's talking about the people who own television, people who own, you know, news, Fox News, CNN, doesn't matter. They all serve the same masters. And certainly the programming has become so debauched. There's actually a part of this book where he talked about a study was conducted in like 1969 of just the violence, the acts of violence that occurred from like during 12 hours of the day for like 1 week on CBS, ABC, NBC. And it was hundreds of acts of violence. So and that was, again, how long ago? That would seem like child's play to us. We're so desensitized intentionally through this television mechanism. American television, in which a cultural monopoly is exercised by a relatively small group, it's a very small group, reflects the insensitivity of the communications process to the tastes and philosophical values of much of America. It was intended to destroy the philosophical values, which it has done beautifully, well, horrifyingly, actually, but it was a very effective at what it was trying to do. Rising public dissatisfaction with this state of affairs indicates that perhaps some change has to come in this field as well. The geographical decentralization and dispersal of the television industry into more numerous units, the separation of broadcasting from program production, and the further extension of educational programming will probably be sharply opposed by existing interests. If past American experience can serve as a relevant guide, change will come by attrition and piecemeal reform rather than by wholesale readjustment. Here again, scientific and technological developments may become the handmaidens of constructive change. They may make possible far greater diversity than today is available, as well as more extensive exploitation of the audiovisual media by more institutions and organizations. Instead of limiting intellectual horizons, television could become a diversified and intellectually enriching source of this society's overall cultural growth. And indeed, as I just mentioned, the opposite is true. So here we see this overall global political plan coming to pass. I mean, let's analyze some of these things 50 years later. The instant communications, the television, all of these things have changed who we are as humans, certainly our way of life, certainly what we think about. Therefore, it changes who we are intrinsically. You know, man is body and soul. And your soul is where your intellect is. And so if you're banging around in your intellect who the third baseman of the Yankees is or who the, you know, striker for Real Madrid is, you ain't talking about anything real there. There's no real knowledge, but they want you to think that that is knowledge, you know? And so this plan for automation, cybernetic control of humanity is reaching greater and greater levels. And it is imperative that we stop this. You know, there's you know, probably some other shows out there that are at least similar to this one, maybe, you know, and if they're not telling you that we need to physically overthrow this regime, these people are committing unbelievable crimes against humanity. Unbelievable. They no longer have the right to exist on planet Earth. If these people are just talking about these problems and they're not saying we need to go out and do something about this physically, they're kind of just siloing you into inaction. You need to be active. You need to do something out there in the real world to stop this. It certainly starts by education. But I don't plan on doing Open Secrets forever. Certainly not. I plan on dedicating my life to stopping these things, to stopping these people, to see that they fall, to see that justice, real justice, is brought into this world for them. And I don't plan on surviving it either. So we must come together and this is what's so powerful. We are at a tipping point here, because if this information can be articulated by smarter people than I and with some poetry to make people actually understand in their hearts what's happening, the evil that's happening to us, we are at a point where we can stop this and we can overthrow them. And it just takes a small percentage of the population to awaken to this and be ready to die for this, because people will. Psychopaths don't respond to protesting in the streets with signs. They don't care. In fact, that's a good thing for them. We need to be invading their castles and putting them on gibbets. I am Dr. Dan Stanislavski. This is Open Secrets. The next episode is going to be on one of my all-time favorites. Despite some of you familiar with this book, it's startling conclusion. It's a book called The Ghost in the Machine. The Ghost in the Machine by Arthur Koestler. We'll do that on the next episode. I love you guys. God bless you all. I hope you are having a wonderful, joyful life. Don't focus too much on the negative. Life is beautiful. There is a lot of beauty to be had in it. So please try and find real, true happiness. God bless you, and I will see you on the next episode of Open Secrets. Thank you.